day and thinking about who Nehemiah was, that he was a Jew that was living in Persian captivity, living in Susa, which was either the capital of Persia or perhaps a winter palace of the Persian kings. And we said that he was a cupbearer to the king. He had access to the king that very few people did during this time. He was a man of influence. And we know later on here in this book, over in chapter 5, later on in the book, that he became the governor when he came back to Jerusalem, the governor of Judah. We mentioned there the first few verses of this chapter that some men came from Judah, and he asked them how the people were doing there, how God's people were doing, and what the city of Jerusalem was like, and they told him things were not good in verse 3. And so verse 4 is kind of where we left off last week with his reaction to that bad news, just like Ezra, when he found out that God's people were committing sin, back in chapters 9 and 10 of that book, that he took that very personally. And he identified with his own people in that, even though he was innocent. And it seems like Nehemiah is doing the same thing here. And so because he was in the position that he was in and had such a connection to King Artaxerxes, that he was able to work on behalf of those exiles that had returned to Jerusalem. Just from that standpoint, I think he's a little bit like Ezra, or a little bit like Esther, I mean. That she had special access to the king. And, you know, we're not told this in the book of Nehemiah, but perhaps the Lord raised him up or put him in this position at this particular time for this reason, so that he could work on behalf of God's people, the remnant that had come back. So we want to look this evening, beginning at his prayer here in chapter 1, beginning at verse 5. And let's just take the time to read this prayer again. It's not a very long prayer, but I believe there are a lot of rich ideas that are mentioned here. Verse 5, here is his prayer. I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances, which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name, and make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. Now I was a cupbearer to the king. So we're thinking here in this lesson from chapter 1 about, in all these lessons about leadership, but thinking about leadership here in the life of Nehemiah, going back again to prayer, what we talked about from the life of Ezra. But prayer preceding action. And so, like Ezra's prayer that we looked at several weeks ago in chapter 9 of that book, Nehemiah's prayer, to me, falls in the same category. It's a very rich prayer. It's a very beautiful prayer. It's a very powerful prayer. It got results, didn't it? And that's what the Lord promises us in the book of James, chapter 5, and verse 16. That if we are righteous people, that our prayers are going to be effective. They are going to work. They're going to get results. So as you think about, if you have studied the book of Nehemiah or know anything at all about Nehemiah, we'll see this as we continue on in our studies in this book. He's very much a man of action. Ezra, as we thought about him, I think he's a man of action, but he seemed to maybe be a little bit more inward focused. I don't know that he's, you know, was an introvert, but his personality seems to be different, at least from my standpoint, from that of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is just, I'm not going to say he's like the Apostle Peter, but he's one that seems, in my mind, really has a hard time sitting still. He wants to get things done. He wants to get out there and start putting things into action. But even though that seems to be his personality, I think it's worth noting, as we did with Ezra, that his first and his most important action was prayer to God. And this wasn't a surface prayer. This wasn't something that he was doing as a matter of ritual or something like that. But I believe this is a very genuine, this is a very heartfelt, this is a very honest prayer. And he was very passionate in praying this prayer to God. One writer said that prayer was the first major step that Nehemiah took in his journey to effective leadership. And so I hope from the lesson we've already looked at with Ezra in this lesson, if we don't get anything else out of this quarter's classes, that we remember how important prayer is for all of us as Christians, but especially those who are going to be leaders of God's people or leaders of our own family. So as we look at his prayer here, verses 5 and 6, he begins his prayer really by focusing upon God. And what does he say about God? What are his thoughts about God? What comes to his mind? There's, when you think about God, you could be praying for hours or days and never exhaust everything there is to say or describe about God. But what is his mind on?
Faithfulness of God.
Okay, the faithfulness of God. And in contrast to that, the faithlessness, of God's people. I think that's a very important characteristic that he mentions here. Anybody see something else?
Interesting, he says the great and terrible.
Okay.
He's one to be feared.
Yes.
Not taken lightly and not to be taken for granted.
All right.
To always remember who he is.
That's true. And Nehemiah definitely did. He was one who feared the Lord. That's a good thought. As he's thinking about his greatness, his being an awesome God, his faithfulness, he's thinking here especially about his faithfulness to his covenant, as he mentions there at the end of verse 5. His faithfulness to his people, even though many times the Israelites were not faithful to him, that's why they went into captivity. And then he wants the Lord there at verse 6 to, he wants to have the Lord's full attention. He wants the Lord's focus. He wants his ear to be open. He wants his eye to be open to the things that Nehemiah is to request of him, the things that he is to say to him. So obviously, as we think about maybe the model prayer that Jesus gives us in the Gospels, I think there's some similarities here that Jesus begins that prayer by recognizing who God is, by praising and honoring and revering God. And Nehemiah is doing the same thing here. Moving on to verses 6 and 7, then he confesses sin, just like Ezra did in his great prayer back in chapter 9. He's not trying to hide sin. He's not trying to beat around the bush. He's not trying to use different terminology to kind of water it down, to make it sound more like it's not as big of a deal as it is. He's just very open and honest and upfront with it. Confessing the sins not only of himself, again, he brings himself into this prayer. He confesses his family sins, his father's sins, his people's sins, those of Israel. And this all in spite of, I think, what Brother Kevin just mentioned back in verse 5, who God is. And what Eddie mentioned, that he's a great God. He's an awesome or terrible God, but he's a faithful God. And God has been faithful to the nth degree to his children, and they have been the exact opposite. Now, go ahead, George.
He knows you can't hold sin in.
That's true.
You've got to bring it out in the light, or it'll still be there. It'll mm-hmm. never go away.
And that's right.
Bring it to the light. And he recognized that in telling them that he sinned.
That's true. And we're going to see this if we have time to get to chapter 13. he deals with some sin in the camp there as well. Several years after, that would have been after Ezra dealt with some sin. But he didn't He didn't play around with sin either. I mean, when he knew that there was sin, he knew he was involved in it. He made sure that they corrected that and that there were consequences. Did you have a comment? Okay. If you look there at verses 8 through 10, this is just kind of summarizing his prayer. If you have something specific that you want to mention, feel free to jump in here. But now it seems like he's kind of going back to the beginning of his prayer. Now he's asking God, because he is a great God, because he is a faithful God, even though his people have been faithless to him, he is asking God to remember his covenant promises that he made so long ago really starting back with, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and fulfilling those promises throughout the generations. And especially this promise that he mentions here that God had made or spoke to Moses, that you know, if the people were not faithful to the Lord, if they disobeyed God, which they did, that he would scatter them from the promised land that he had brought them into. But he also made a promise on the positive side, if there were some who turned back to him and became faithful to him, that he would bring them back to that promised land. It didn't matter where they had gone in the rest of the world, God had the power to scatter them, and God had the power to collect them and to bring them back. And so it seems like Nehemiah is calling again upon the faithfulness of God, and not that God needed to be reminded of his promises at all, but Nehemiah was wanting the Lord here to just remember his promise. And I think, you know, sometimes the things that we pray for may be more for our benefit, because God knows everything. But I think God wants to hear those requests from us. There at verse 10 even, he reminds the Lord, or says, that they are your servants. They're your people. These are the people that you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. And then verse 11, he is asking God to take some action. And so he's wanting God to hear his prayer again as he began this prayer, but also asking God to hear and to answer the prayers of other faithful Israelites, other Israelites that feared Jehovah just like he did. And especially he was being very specific about himself at the end of verse 11. And what did he want the Lord to do for him? Okay. All right.
I think you're just asking God to help him to be open to the opportunity that, as God presented it to him, that he would prosper in that matter.
All right. Yeah, I don't think that this was a selfish request. As we look at Nehemiah, especially later on in chapter 2, you know, everything that he was doing here really was for God, first of all, and then for God's people. You know, he wasn't trying to advance himself. He wasn't trying to become well known. He was very serious about trying to do the Lord's work and to help the Lord's people. And so he's about to stand before King Artaxerxes, being the cupbearer again. I'm sure he had been in his presence many times, but this was going to be a different situation because he had something very serious on his mind. Go ahead, Brother Jim.
There's a thought going back to verse 6 that his prayer was not just a one-shot situation.
That's true.
But he prays day and night for the children of Israel. So he was a man who was accustomed to coming before God's throne in prayer. And we need to be that type of people, that praying day and night, constantly coming before God in prayer. So if something like this comes up in our lives, it's not something that's unique or unusual.
That's a good point. You know, especially for leaders, as we as husbands and fathers lead our families, if we are in regular communication with God, there are going to be situations that come up in our family and in a local church that are not our making. You know, we wake up one morning and the sun's shining brightly and everything seems to be going well, and then we get a phone call. Then we, you know, have a conversation with someone that's a Christian or someone that's in our family, and you know, our whole day has changed. How do we deal with that? The first thought that we ought to have is to go to God in prayer about that, because we're not going to be successful in in dealing with that situation if we don't have God guiding us in that. But you're right. It seems like here, as I think we mentioned last week, from chapter 1 and verse 1, telling us that it was in the month Chislev, and then chapter 2 and verse 1, when he actually appeared before the king in the month Nisan, that would have been about 4 or 5 months, I think. So, again, even though the text does not come right out and state this, I think that it's very possible, maybe more than possible, probable, that Nehemiah was praying to God about this every day, you know, for that period of time. So he was a man who was very devoted to prayer. So I think we can learn here for all of us, but for godly leaders, first of all, recognize who God is. Doesn't matter what position they may see themselves in, but they first of all recognize that God is the creator of all, that God is to be feared and to be obeyed and trusted. They recognize who they are. Yes, they may be a leader, but in comparison to God's power, you know, there is no comparison. They think about his promises, recall them to mind, and godly leaders have to rest their hope on the promises of God. They have to rest their hope on God's word. I mean, there are a lot of situations, again, for us as husbands, as fathers, for elders in the local church, especially, that situations come up, and you think, how in the world am I going to deal with this? You know, what is the solution to this problem? It may be a very complicated problem, like we look back in Ezra chapter 9 and 10. But we have to depend upon God and put our hope in His Word and in His promises, and then ask for God to act on our behalf and to show us the way we need to go. So any other thoughts there on Nehemiah's prayer? Okay, moving into chapter 2, and this, at least the first part of this chapter, I think, is a good follow-up to prayer, because it wasn't just that he prayed this prayer and then he sat down and said, okay, Lord, I'm just waiting for you to act. I'm waiting for you to, you know, perform a miracle or do something great here. But he really became the answer to his own prayer. And so I want us to read here the first 8 verses of chapter 2 and find out what the action was that followed his prayer. The text goes on there and says, and it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Then the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me, because the good hand of my God was on me. So again, I think we see a connection here between his prayer and the action that he took. Again, another writer, Derek Kidner, that I use some in the Psalms and this part of the Bible with the history books, made this comment here. He said, since Nehemiah's natural bent was for swift, decisive action, his behavior back in chapter 1 and verse 4, we talked about him sitting down, you know, about being a very busy man and the work and position that he had as cupbearer to the king, but he took a break from that work. His behavior back in that verse is remarkable in his following prayer. It shows where his priorities lay. It also reveals the unhurried and far from superficial background to the famous arrow prayer of chapter 2 and verse 4 and to the achievements which were to follow from it. So again, as we've already mentioned, you know, I think his prayer that we just read in chapter 1 was I don't know that he said those exact words for 4 or 5 months, but that was kind of the gist of it. That was his daily prayer on behalf of his people. And so when he's presented opportunity, as Sister Kathy said, even though verse 4 tells us that he prayed to God about that when King Artaxerxes said, "What do you want?" I think he already really knew the answer to that because he had been praying for these things. And so, how did that prayer prepare Nehemiah? If you look here in verses 1 and 2, is there anything significant about him being sad in the king's presence? Does anybody know? I don't know if anybody did any reading or knows, about the Persian kings and sadness. Some things that I read just said that really the Persian kings, I think they were like a lot of kings. They looked at themselves as being supreme. It was kind of like the pharaohs, kind of like, King Nebuchadnezzar being God on earth. And if someone were sad in their presence, then that meant somehow they had, done something wrong. And they did not like for people to be sad before them when they came before their court. And so I was thinking again about, Esther. When she came before the king Ahasuerus, and, she didn't know because she had not been invited, because she didn't follow the protocol, if the king would accept her or not, if she would lose her life. And I think that seems to be the situation here with Nehemiah when he says there in verse 2, even though he's been praying about this for months and he has confidence that God is going to answer his prayer, and when God provides him an opportunity, that he's going to give him the courage that he needs to ask for the things that he needs, he still has some fear. I think that's just a natural human reaction. He doesn't know maybe exactly how the king is going to react to this. He doesn't know if the king's going to, like he did with Esther, hold out his golden scepter and there be peace, or he may say, off with this man. He's not fit to live. And so it's kind of interesting to me, how he, and I think this is really the preparation that his prayer gave to him. In verse 3, the first words out of his mouth were, "Let the king live forever." And then at verse 5, even after the king asked him, "What is your request?" he says, "If it please the king, if your servant has found favor before you." And then we read there at verse 6 that it did please the king. Verse 7 again, he talks to King Artaxerxes and he says, "If it please the king." Going back to the end of his prayer, back in verse 11 of chapter 1, he was asking the Lord to grant him success. He was asking the Lord that he might find favor in Artaxerxes' eyes. And we have to remember, about all these kings, King Artaxerxes, King Ahasuerus, other kings. These were not godly people. I don't know how well he knew the character of the king at this point, but he was going in, talking to someone who did not believe in Jehovah. And he was really making a request for the Lord's people. So I think we could see how he could have some fear, but he doesn't seem to have any timidity about him. He seems to have a lot of courage, and certainly leaders need much courage. So I think his prayer did a few things for him. It gave him confidence again to appear before the king. It gave him boldness to tell the king exactly what he and his people needed. He didn't beat around the bush when the king asked the question there in verse 4. He just gets right to it, verses 5 through 8. Something else interesting that I read about the Persian kings is, as Nehemiah says there back in verse 3 and 5, when the king asked him what was he wanting, that he mentions that he wanted to go back to the place of his father's tombs, that some of the Persian kings just really, I guess that struck a chord with them, or struck a nerve with them. Just the way that he is phrasing things here, I think he is showing a lot of wisdom. He is being wise as a serpent, and in the way that he is presenting his request. Another interesting thing that I think I read that I hadn't thought about in verse 5, that he was asking King Artaxerxes to send him to Judah. He didn't specifically mention Jerusalem, at this point. He just kind of getting the general region. And I think, again, going about this the right way. So then this prayer also gave him what he needed to take action on behalf of his people. And verse 9 tells us there, he says, "Then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen." So we didn't look at this back in the book of Ezra, but back in chapter 8, I believe it was, where he could have had some soldiers go along with him and the exiles that returned back to Jerusalem. He declined that. Here, Nehemiah accepts that. Perhaps he's wanting to come back with power. You know, he knows, because there has been at least 14 or 15 years since Ezra and his crew have returned. He knows all the opposition that's been going on from the peoples of the lands, and even from some Jews that were living there, opposing the building of the temple, opposing the building of the city walls. And so it seems like he wants to come back, you know, with everything in order. And he wants to come back with the king's power. But more than that, I still believe he is relying upon the Lord's power to help him in this situation. So again, as we think about prayer and as it relates to action, prayer really takes our minds off of ourselves. It takes our minds off of our circumstances. And sometimes, as leaders, we can be bogged down. Sometimes it's not just one situation like we read about in Ezra 9 and 10 that comes along, but before we can really get into that, then another stressful situation comes along, another stressful circumstance comes along, we have to deal with that. But prayer really takes our minds off ourselves, off our circumstances. It puts our minds on God and His power, and it gives us the peace of mind that we need, so that as we're moving into this next section in chapter 2, so that we can have a clear head. We can have a clear mind and put forth a clear plan or vision for people that we're leading to follow. So we've kind of run through that section pretty quickly. Does anybody else have something that you want to add? Go ahead, Brother Jim.
You mentioned he didn't say go back to Jerusalem, but go back to Judah. In Ezra chapter 4, they tried to build the walls, but the enemies wrote to the king of Persia, said that Jerusalem is a rebellious city. And so Jerusalem had a reputation. And I think it's significant, as you pointed out, he didn't say, "I want to go to Jerusalem, I want to go to Judah," because of that reputation Jerusalem had.
That's right. I think back there in, let's see, Ezra 4 and about verse 21, this was the king's decree or edict about that, or telling his men about that. He says, "So now issue a decree to make these men stop the work, that this city may not be rebuilt until a decree is issued by me." So, you know, he could kind of reverse that or issue another decree. And we find here, you know, again, Artaxerxes is now allowing Nehemiah to return. And not just to return, but to give him the supplies, the protection, everything that he needs to go back and to do to fully accomplish that work. So he definitely has the favor of the king. And that's what one thing that he prayed for. God answered his prayer in a very powerful way. Verse 10 is significant because we're going to read about these men several times here in the book of Nehemiah. It wasn't just all sunshine and roses. There's always opposition. You know, when we try to do the Lord's work, as much as we spend time in prayer, as much as we spend time planning that work and then getting busy to do that work, we can know that the Lord is there with us, helping us, but there's also Satan, our enemy, working in that as well. And so we read here in verse 10, "When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite heard about Nehemiah's plans and his return, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel." So keep those two guys in mind along with, if we get to the end of this chapter, this evening or next week, another guy named Geshem down in verse 19. Just like we saw with Ezra, you know, there with trying to correct the sin that was among the people with marrying the foreign women, there were a few names that were mentioned, even a few leaders that opposed Ezra in that. So we're always going to face opposition, and we as leaders need to be ready for that. And that requires that we pray a lot about that. That requires that we get into God's Word and we seek God's wisdom so we can best attack that enemy and we can overcome him. Verses 11 through 20, let's read that section. He says, "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal in which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.' I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they put their hands to the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' So I answered them and said to them, 'The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem.'" So thinking about just three verses here, first of all, verses 11, 12, and 16. And this was one of the questions that I had on the question sheet. Can you see anything here that these verses tell us about Nehemiah, his character, or even about his leadership? Well, that's kind of open-ended. Okay. He's a man of action, isn't he? But he doesn't just rush headlong into it, not like King Saul in that regard. You know, just thinking, well, here's what I want to do, and not being patient, not waiting on Samuel to come back the 3 days that he had given. So I think he shows a lot of patience there at verse 11, that he comes to Jerusalem. He doesn't just immediately get everybody working, but he says that he's there 3 days. I don't know exactly what he was doing during that 3-day time. Perhaps he is spending more time in prayer now that he's here. Perhaps he is talking to some of the officials that have been here for years and really trying to get a good grasp on the situation. But I don't think he's just sitting around twiddling his thumbs. You know, he is ready to act, but he's going to wait first. Brother Duke?
Jews to get them rallied around the project.
Okay. And I think that is a good thing, especially for leaders to remember. You know, he wanted to put forth a good plan for them, but you know, he's just come into the city. Many of these have been living here for years. You know, and so they could look at him as kind of being an outsider. Who are you to come in and tell us this is what we need to do to fix this problem? I think he shows a lot of patience, a lot of wisdom in that. And as Brother Duke said, you know, he was trying to get as much information together as he could. We as leaders need to do that as well, don't we? Again, whether it's in our own family, whether it's in a local congregation of God's people. You know, someone comes to us with a problem, we don't need to just hastily jump into it and think perhaps we're going to solve it all today. Sometimes we need to back up, and I learned this a long time ago as a young preacher. There was a, where we lived in Alabama, I think it was a mother of one of our teenage ladies. She was dating a young man, and she called me on the phone one evening and was all upset about the situation. And being a young single guy, you know, I took all that to heart until a few days later I talked to this guy that she was dating. He wasn't a Christian, but kind of found out some, you know, other information that had been left out. And it pays to get all the information, all the facts, before you start trying to solve a problem. And so we as leaders are, I think, really can take a lesson from Nehemiah in that regard. Here in verses 12 and 16, again, as he's walking around the city walls, he's doing that at night, I think, not because he's scared, I don't believe. He's a man of great courage, but he's not really wanting to draw attention to himself. He's just wanting to get out there with a few other men that he has chosen. He's keeping his plans to himself until he has all the information he needs. One interesting thing to me there at verse 12 is he said that he was not telling anyone what God was putting into his mind to do for Jerusalem. I don't believe God was, you know, just overriding his will. But again, because he had been praying about this matter for so long, it was as if really the plans that he was enacting, he believed were God's plans. And they were not. He was not wanting to carry out these plans again so that he could promote himself, as many leaders do. He was wanting to do something for Jerusalem, for the Lord's people. So he shows a lot of trust in God, I believe, as well, formulating a successful plan. He shows a lot of prudence and maybe waiting till the right time, you know, to reveal this plan, this action. And all those things are things that godly leaders do. So as Sister Kathy said, one writer said this, that a good leader doesn't rush into his work, but he patiently gathers the facts firsthand and then plans his strategy. You know, sometimes, especially we as men, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, if we know that there's a problem, I mean, I don't like there to be problems. Some people maybe do, but, you know, if there's a problem that's presented to me, it's just kind of my natural thought, first of all, is, okay, well, let's solve this problem right now. You know, and then we can move on to the next thing, and life can be peaceful and happy again. But all problems aren't solved in a day. And what we need to do, first of all, is to just step back from that to make sure that we have, again, all the facts that we need so that we can make a good, wise, right decision about that. Let's see here. We've only got, well, looks like he's about ready to ring the bell. Any other thoughts? We have maybe a few seconds left.
Yeah.
We'll come back to this section next week.
I found out in the short time I've been alive that all problems cannot be solved. You cannot solve every problem that is presented unto you. And that's where our faith in the Lord has to... We just have to have faith that he'll help us.
That's true. I mean, but God can solve every problem. And there's a lot of problems, again, as leaders that are not, we haven't made that problem, but it's just presented, it's kind of laid in our lap. So I think that's a great thought. Next week we will finish up this section. Because we're kind of a week behind, we may combine some things here.